What I would like to do briefly is to give an overview of what it costs to run the legal profession. And this is specifically with regard to the attorney's profession and what is the costs to do that. You see on the screen, we tried to have them printed, but it didn't come out. It's on Excel, so I'm hoping you'll be able to just see the figures. But just by way of indication, the biggest law society is the Law Society of Northern Provinces, LSNP. As you know, that's Gauteng, Mpumalanga, Northwest, and Limpopo. So that's 62 million.
A point of clarity before we start, can we get this on distributed by email?
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't have to worry about that.
I sent it to Boyani. You do? Yes, we do. Sure. Yes.
And why are we doing this?
Well, it's just to give a very brief overview.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
So what I want to do then is to quickly look at what the Fidelity Fund pays for, both the costs for the Law Society, including the LSA. And I've just quickly added up the following figures because those are not the exhaustive costs. If you take the National Law Library, that's based at KZN, that's 2 million. You've got disciplinary and regulatory costs, that's 12.5 million. Risk management programs at the Law Society is funded by fund, that's 16 million. Trust account audit fees, 36 million. Trust account bank charges, 37 million. Agency fees, this is very, very interesting, because for the Law Society to act as a conduit, they charge an agency fee of 50%, and there's a handsome sum of 43 million that the Fidelity Fund pays, which money, in my humble opinion, could be paid by practitioners directly to the Fidelity Fund and you save 43 million. It's very interesting. The agency agreement exists, and there's a big amount that the Law Societies use in terms of funding their activities. And in this modern day and age of EFTs, it begs the question, are we missing something?
You may need to explain to us, but what is this agency?
Well,
what do they do?
If they collect the money into their trust account at the Law Society, and they give it to the Fidelity Fund.
Oh, quintessential middleman.
Yes. For that, 40%, and that transaction is 43 million.
In their own profession.
Yes. And enhancement of professional standards, the biggest chunk there is funding the LSSA, and that's 70 million. And then, of course, the indemnity insurance with the AIIF, Attorney's Insurance Indemnity Fund. And, of course, the claim is 122 million. So I did a quick calculation of what the fund pays over to the profession, and that comes up to about 230 million, which is slightly over the initial amount that we saw when you add up the other two figures. So those are the big line items that will give us an idea as to what it costs to run the profession, and that's all I really wanted to talk to the chairperson.
All right. Before I recognize you, I'm going to say hi. It's fine. But I think the question that emanated from members was, this law, what does it cost to implement, and how, where will money come from to implement? That's the amazing question.
Chair, the funding model is going to be wholly dependent on what we do with regards to certain key issues. What are the roles of the regional councils? How many regional councils do we have? You will see that we have 4 regional councils, and it's 100 million. The mortgage will cost you more than that. So you need to factor that in. And then over and above that, you need to look at what else is there that can be saved in the process. If you're just looking at these figures, there are certain items in terms of the structure of the council, and if you look at the SSA, for all intents and purposes, could be the National Legal Affairs Council in terms of how it's structured. It's a council, it's facilities. It meets every second month, and that. So those are the amounts. Of course, when it comes to the actual determination, it might very well be the whole issue of the 43 million is going to be taken very, very seriously in the PC stage, and discussions may emanate that let's get the money directly and put it in the ring rank from agency fees. And in terms of structuring the council, in terms of structuring the regional councils, how do we save money in terms of those entities? And what are their actual functions? Because currently, the provincial law societies do not only do regulatory affairs matters, which are two matters. One is discipline, and the second one is admissions. So those are strictly regulatory affairs. But they also do member interest work, seminars, a whole lot of everything to do with a whole lot of special committees, tax, company law, all those various committees that exist and are duplicated throughout the provinces at all the provincial law societies, again, replicated at the national level for the LSSA. So one would have to look at how do you manage those processes and are those committees that are going to be set up by the National Council, are they going to be duplicated at provincial level? Is it necessary to have national committees? Those are the hard discussions that will happen during the consultative stage, aka GC. How do we limit the costs and how do we operate effectively going forward? And I do believe that the funding amount will be greatly reduced by those discussions. Whether it will be halved is possible, whether the fund will say we can't carry on with the current model as they have said, and this was the determination that we believe is all we could put into the figure, and we believe that 100 million is what you have to work with, and let's see how you can do that. I think in discussions between the fund and the law societies, they've been asked to seriously consider narrowing down the way in which they operate and find a way in which the figures that is being presented to the fund on a yearly basis, the fund to fund, is greatly reduced. And indeed, what has happened is that the contributions from the fund has reduced dramatically, which has seen law societies levying extra payments on the members. I think the reality check for the legal profession is we are not going to be able to continue in the way in which we currently continue, and we're going to have to scale down and operate more efficiently without compromising the core needs and standards that must be observed and protection of the property. And so the ultimate figure that is going to be put up to fund the organized profession, including the advocates, because that amount has to be factored in. In the sense that, of course, we will be part of those structures, but in my mind, I'm not terribly worried about the fact that they are, because the meeting will just have the members attending, the separate meeting, the committee is already there. So there's a lot of committees, but there has to be a figure, I suppose, for matters that might be peculiar to the administration. And we've tried as a department to try and come up with a funding amount. And what is it based on? Part of our challenge was, well, we don't know what committee is going to ultimately decide so far as the Legal Council concerns, and that's where we left. There are two sources. The biggest source is the federal funds. And all member interest matters paid you in sanctions, the provision of safety. The department will fund two line items. One, it will fund the Transitional Arms Council, and it will fund the Office of the Army.
Mr. Swart and then Mrs. Schaefer.
Good day, thank you for that. We need costing of the book. That's the bottom line. And yes, you're correct in saying it depends on some of the structures that we're going to agree on. But basically, there are some issues that we need costing. We need costing of the Ombudsman. That's going to be funded by the Minister. We need costing of the Transitional Council. That's coming from the fiscus. So those items can be worked out, depending, and then either we will accept the Transitional Council or we won't. And then I think that is a given. We need as far as possible. When we pass legislation, our biggest concern is it can't be implemented because the funds aren't there. And that is often in my experience over 15 years or myself. So we need more detail. And I know it's not easy because this is going to be funded later from the provisional bond. But when we estimate fees, clearly our biggest concern is what is it going to cost the practitioners in the long term and what impact is that going to have on your attorney. There are already submissions both from the advocate and the attorneys that if the tariffs are increased, that will put your civil practitioners out of practice. Considering the fact that the pool of work is reducing, that's the point I've already argued. So we need to be very mindful of what is going to cost in the long term, particularly as beyond the transitional phase are going to be funded by the profession itself. Now, you've given us some good figures that we need to look at, but clearly we need a lot more work done on the costing model of the implementation of the legislation. And you've raised some interesting aspects, but I'm not so sure that your assumption that it's going to be greatly reduced by understandability is correct. Normally it ends up costing more at the end of the day, particularly if you consider, for example, the stipends for pupils. If that does not come into the CETAs, for example, then there's an additional cost item there. How one works out the different regional councils. So I think that we need to be very mindful of that and what impact the implementation of this bill will have on the profession itself in the long term. And will it in fact result in smaller practitioners going out of practice and just not being able to afford the additional levy that may be applied to the full implementation of the bill? Thank you for that. Mrs. Schaefer.
Yes, thanks. Some of my concerns have been already expressed. I agree. I mean, we have received a number of submissions saying that there are attorneys who can't even afford the current 3,000 rand levy per year that the Law Society currently imposes. So the effect of that will be that they will go out of business, and then obviously the percentage of fee levies payable by the other attorneys will increase as well. Now the thing is, what exactly are the current sources of income? What percentage comes from the fund, what percentage comes from levies in the various, that's what I would have to know at the moment, because you say the fund has already reduced the amount that they give. And then, correct me if I'm wrong, but the LSA is a statutory body, therefore it's under the state, no? Is that the voluntary body? Okay, so the number one is the money that comes from, the fund and the law society? Is any money coming from the state at the moment? Nothing at all. Okay. All right, no, then that's fine.
Maybe I could just respond on the funding request of Honourable Swart. We will provide the committee with details. The current figures that the department has worked on the cost of the TC is around 10 million rand, and the figure that we've worked out for the Office of Ombuds is 21. So we have resources within the department that are interrogating those costs with a
follow-up.
And with a view to look at whether we couldn't reduce that even further. In the current budget, we want to make certain that we are covered in terms of that figure that we are looking at. And so the necessary applications to Treasury is being done to ensure that that is into place. But the actual breakdown of the figures we will send to the committee, so that they could have a check of how we come up. process. But I just thought I'd just give you the ballpark so that you have an idea that it's not so we haven't started the process and looked at what is it going to cost. Yes, we'll give you the detail of how we come to those estimates.
And the income currently, how much is received from which source at the moment to run the...
You mean from the profession?
Yeah, wherever it comes from. If some comes from the fund, some comes from the profession. How much is coming from the profession? How much is coming from the...
Yes.
Yes.
At the
moment,
yes. Again, you correct, and thank you for those figures about the figures that will be required from the FIFA. I presume, and you say you are doing applications for National Treasury, but you recall that we last year were coming 600 million and short in the Treasury for the department. So that is a major concern again. But besides that, the issue to me is also the ongoing discussions with the profession. I think that is imperative. And I think we've already invited them to participate, and they are here, but as far as costing of this model in the long term, I'd like us there to be aware of that. So that assists you as well in when you're looking at costing. You know, are the figures that you're getting, and obviously you need to consider the bar time for their figures as well. So, firstly from this side and then from our side as well, whether it's accurate reflection in as much as when you indicated that it will cost a lot cheaper in the longer term. Would the profession agree with that view or not? Is the question. Thank you, Chief.
I don't change my mind at all. My concern is the following. I thought that by doing this new structure, independent applicants and so on would then brought all under the same kind of structure and qualifications and requirements as GCP is now. After what yesterday, how we ended, it doesn't appear to be the case. Now, I don't see how it's envisaged. And it goes back to this, I can't see how we can have people who have one degree, exactly the same, and some people can the day after they admit it appear in every quarter of the country without any further training whatsoever. And attorneys can't, and they've been in these 2 years of them. And I'm not saying, I'm not conflating the two, and I'm not saying they should be the same, and I'm not saying it should be unified. But what I'm saying is, should there not be something like, after 6 months of something, the advocates can appear in the higher courts, or some options, because they have more trial advocacy and it's more intensive than their attorneys, and it's more general and stuff. But if attorneys can only appear in the regional courts and above, well, only regional courts, after 1 year of other courts, surely there must be something similar for advocates also. I mean, maybe 6 months of trial advocacy training, then they can appear in the higher courts. But I mean, it's quite right that you can have the same, exactly the same qualification, and some people can appear the very next day in every court in the country at this point. It's just isn't right. And not fair on the public, right?
Chair, I think the people susceptible after 6 months, it's only after 6 months that they, once there was an exam, after 6 months you write your first exam, and once you've passed that exam, and obviously once you've been admitted in court, you can appear, but obviously it's not for the other. You cannot appear as a pupil before the first 6 months and before you have passed that specific exam, and which is normal after 6 months in any court.
I think that's the point that Mrs. Schaefer is making. Any court, whereas attorneys are confined to.
Attorneys are confined to magistrate courts for their first year, which is okay, and then they send to a regional court, and only once they're admitted after their exam, then they still have to practice for another 3 years before they can appear in the high court, and then you have to apply. Whereas advocates can get the same degree, and day one at the moment, as things stand, they can appear in any court in the country. Now, I mean, what I'm saying is we should have some kind of, all advocates should first of all be the same. I mean, that's what I understood this process to be about, is to try and bring, incorporate the independent advocates and GCP all together. So surely then we should at least prescribe, in a way, after 6 months of advocacy training, which will be prescribed by the council, then they can appear in something like that.
So just to respond to Ms. Adams, Ms. Adams is talking about the position at the bar, GCP, so we must just keep that in mind. I'm sure that independent advocates, there's no such restriction. They can appear on the first day after they get there. So we must just keep that in mind. It's difficult to respond to this because the situation now, we can't change. We're changing the situation by means of the bill. And just to reaffirm, everybody, pupils and candidate attorneys, are going to go through a process of vocational training and competency admission exams, or attorneys admission exams, similar to that, and your bar admission exams, similar to that. And then only after that will they be able to be admitted. We're talking now about course 25, which the department was requested to put in as an option to retain the current statutory arrangement in terms, in respect of candidates, attorneys, and the right of appearance of attorneys. There's no equivalent statutory arrangement in respect of advocates at this stage. I just wanted to make that point. And it really is up to the committee, the bill as we introduced clause 25 through everything open. Attorneys can appear in every court, and the question relating to appearance in court as a candidate legal practitioner was not addressed in the bill. It was left for the transition. It's one of the issues that the transitional council is going to look at, but the department was requested to also retain or reiterate the statutory arrangement for candidates, attorneys, and we can only do it for candidate attorneys because there's no legal basis for people's appointments.
I think Ms. Schaefer, without addressing the issues you've raised, you're going to have to persuade the members of the portfolio committee. Certainly, I'm not saying Mr. Joseph's views, Mr. Dyer's views, Mr. Long's views, or Mr. Bartman's views. Not important, there are certainly, but but at the end of the day, it's us who will decide what goes in here next to it.
Alright, might be repetitious, but we'll A matter of the independence of the legal profession comes into play. A regulator makes rules and prevents them. They have exactly the same status as regulations made by a minister. I think that we need to discuss, but I think that there will be very few instances in which it will be acceptable for the minister to make extraordinary legislation. We have to be wary of the whole issue of executive intrusion on what is an independent profession. Therefore, Clause 27 to me is the most desirable place to deal with this issue. The way it is phrased is to correct. The council must in rule, not the minister by the certainly not that official. The council must in rule. The chairman minimum conditions would be very distressed and admin practical. Okay, so thank you. And I think you're right, including a mechanism to
concerned about that after a meeting I had last night on a specific forum. And I mean, the teachers apparently are in tail, and I have a very serious concern about abusing them for this purpose. Because I had another discussion with an advocate colleague of mine, and he said exactly the same thing. Well, then people just won't take on people because they can't. And why did they pay individually and be told how much to pay? I mean, it's a huge intrusion on their perception to say you will be compelled to pay on people and you will be compelled to pay on extra friends. So then we've got to move into the CETA story. But I'm not convinced that the CETAs are going to come up with the money we now have required. And they already aren't, as far as EPT colleges are concerned. There are huge problems with the CETAs not paying money that the same person today. And I'm really concerned about whether that's going to carry over into this aspect. And I think we need criteria that far more. But I'm not sure that she could put the CETAs into that as well.
So we have that.
Where you are accepted. But I just want clarity also
Is it our intention that at the end of the day, whatever minimum amount we set, that it should be the same for candidate attendance as well as payables?
Well,
I mean, if we say that they should get paid, it's one thing to say that they should get paid. It's another thing with each one grant and whether it's the same as that of, because especially if there is a set amount or a minimum amount set somewhere for candidate attorneys, I just think that it should be in line with, for example, pupils, irrespective of where it is written. You don't have to put the amount, I'm just saying, in principle, it should be that.
Mentioning what the assessment is about, but in the room, in terms of procedure, which you directly intention of disability medication obtaining is, and the purpose is to establish whether the person has attained an adequate level of competence for admission and enrollment.
Is it envisaged, because I see the word engage, is it envisaged that the council will only deal with a appropriate institution, should not be institutions or nice with organizations, threats of those councils, it's conceivable that there will be more than one institution capable of doing it.
Send over to the guy for now.
Yes. Mr. Bassett is saying singular includes plural. In terms of the interpretation expert, give me
all right. No. It's fine. Someone just assumed that you understand these things. We've been working long enough with Mr. Bassett. All right. The chamber. Hold on.
Thank you very much, Chairman. I'm going to say my piece, and I know that I'm interested in hearing Mr. Swartz will say his own piece, and I'm not familiar with his own piece.
And nobody else's?
I'm interested in everybody's opinion in the nature of things.
Okay.
But as I said, and that's one of the reasons why it's important to ask Mr. Swartz. Chairman, I wanted to deal with two aspects that you will let me. The one is legal concerns that I have, which I believe is ought to be discussed. And then the other are a practical concern and arguments in favour of the two dances. Very practical and are greatly informed by some of the discussions we had yesterday, for example. But first on the legal concern. The issue that has been referred to today is what may the executive do and not do. There has been concern about the ministers and powers. But I want to raise something else. There's another question, and that is what can Parliament do and what can't it do? And I raise this because of something Judge Chattelson said in that last speech of his before the Cape Law Society on the 9th of November. Steve Swart cited him yesterday in respect of a separate issue, the dissolution clause, where Judge Chattelson said the dissolution is inconsistent with the independence of the profession. That's a simple fact. There's the authority. I've suggested to you that I'm sure that the legal fraternity would challenge you or her on that issue alone, and they have the authority in their battles. And now I'd like to point you to something else he said in that speech, which I think is highly significant. He said as follows, and I quote, "Although not specifically mentioned in the Constitution, the judiciary depends on an independent legal profession to enable it to perform its constitutional duty. This is an incident of the rule of law which is entrenched in our Constitution. As Chastelson says, the independence of the profession is entrenched in the Constitution. It is an incident of the rule of law." Okay. Now, this link with the rule of law, he said, is affirmed in the Commonwealth Latimer House Principles, also in the International Bar Association standards for the independence of the legal profession, and so forth. Now, Timon, as we've seen, much is made. The Latimer House Principles, the IBA, are cited in most of the submissions we've had, but especially the United Nations Principles. Much is made of the United Nations Principles on Independent Silt's Regulation. You remember how they read. They say, lawyers shall be entitled to form and join self-governing professional associations to represent their interests, promote their continuing education and training, and protect their professional integrity. And this is, they must elect their own executive. Now, we've listened to everybody argue the same thing, but we know that none of these are all soft laws, they're soft international laws. None of these principles, including the United Nations, has stopped any comparable jurisdiction from wholesale reform of the regulation of the legal profession. The latest one is Australia, which also after a painful 10-year period of tension, has just this month instituted upright co-regulation by government and the profession in the eastern seaboard state where most of the lawyers function. So the UN principles we've heard repeatedly, we've taken notes, but it has occurred to us throughout the process that those are the same international soft law principles that apply everywhere. That hasn't stopped literally every country you can imagine, comparable jurisdictions, from the wholesale reform of the regulation of it. However, if just after Chastelson says the independence of the legal profession is an incident of the rule of law, and that is the law and prophets, I mean, that is the authority speaking, and I think that we had better be aware of that. Because should a challenge come after we have finished with this law, that I have absolutely no doubt will be a pillar of the argument. What does it mean to say that it's the independence of the profession, although not stated in the Constitution, is an incident? What does it mean? I think we need to ask ourselves all the things it means. But one of the things it means is that we have to comply. The doctrine of legality. It's not only the executive that has to comply with the doctrine of legality and the other aspects of the rule of law, it's also Parliament. And that means that we, like the executive, we can exercise no power beyond that conferred upon us by law. We can't have ulterior purpose. We must consume our powers. Whatever we do must be rationally related to the purpose for which the power is conferred. Otherwise, it's irrational and arbitrary. Now, the power conferred on us obviously includes rulemaking as our primary power. And I think part and parcel of this would be that any limitations this law imposes on the freedom of trade, occupation, and profession would obviously have to meet the reasonable and justifiable standards of the limitations rules. And I think that goes without saying. Not that I think we've applied our minds to it enough. But what else does it mean that we have to be rational in exercising our powers? I think it merits a very great deal of thought, and I'll give you one example where I think what is being done here is not rational. I don't think we can, quote, transform and, quote, restructure an independent profession when we can't explain what that means, or why it is necessary, or how it isn't an unjustifiable limitation on the independence of a profession said to be entrenched in the Constitution. what it's worth, I think we should substitute the word transformed wherever it appears with rationalized. Because we're really doing what Schedule 666 of the Constitution says, in the same way that we rationalize the courts. We rationalize the courts to coincide with the new provincial boundary and with the terms of the Constitution. We are in many ways doing the same thing, because we are also discontinuing old provincial boundaries, as in the case of the law societies. We are repealing homeland laws, as we did in the Superior Courts Bill, and we are obliterating old borders. So I think we are not transforming, we are rationalizing the profession, and I think that argument can persuasively be made. Even bringing the 4,000 advocates out of the 6,000 who operate without the bars and without rules, even bringing them in under the umbrella works for me as a Schedule 616 measure. So I would suggest that we stop saying that we are transforming the profession, that means absolutely nothing. We all understand what we mean by transformation in ordinary English. I subscribe to it, I support it, but it's not a statutory word. And you can't just assume that it means something it doesn't in a statute. We should say rationalization. And I think what restructured should mean, because again, what does it mean? The entire bill is from the ideas of transformation and restructuring, and I don't know what they mean. I think what restructuring should mean is the separation of regulation and representation. Restructuring can't mean the arbitrary lumping together of attorneys and advocates. Because I'm afraid that I think the process so far just arbitrarily lumps them together. And I'm obviously coming to the chamber this year. The case for a unified profession, which used to be written into this bill, the case for a unified profession was not made. And we have not abandoned that. We've now said we are making a unified regulator. But the case for the unified regulator hasn't yet been made either. I think it can be made, at least up to a point, but it hasn't yet been made. So then we have to be able to answer why are we creating a unified regulator. But there's something I need to say as an aside. Because I'm speaking in essence in support of the proposal from the General Council of the Bar, not all of its details, but I'm in essence supporting their proposal of two chambers. So I need to say that I therefore necessarily disagree with Advocate Isaac, who resigned on exactly this issue. He resigned from the GCB because he believes the regulatory functions of the GCB cannot be based on a statutory footing. I believe they can. The judges of England expressed themselves in favour of effectively just that, a two-chamber statutory regulator of solicitors and barristers. And you know that the English did invent the rule of law. They don't have a written constitution. But there is not such a difference between constitutionalism and the rule of law, which is why we have them sitting together snugly in Section 2. The English judges have expressed themselves in favour of this as the next development in English regulation. English regulator has already anticipated what he calls a single rolled-up regulator for solicitors and barristers, which would be created within 3 years. So that is the model being proposed. It has precedence. Now, on the legal questions, what can Parliament do and what can't it do? Part and parcel of the regulatory function of the provisions is the creation of practice and conduct rules. I have to ask the question, can Parliament change practice rules? In that Defratas case on the referral rule that I've been referring to, both Judge Eustafa and Judge Cameron said that the bars themselves to deal with the referral rule, so the courts are the final arbiter. Judge Schiffer said it would not be appropriate for Parliament to change referral rules, but the bars have thought about absolutely nothing since Judge Cameron's urging to them in 1999, urging to change the referral rule. They don't. What do we do if they don't change the rule? Parliament did legislate on contingency fees, and the Law Society of the Northern Province has just ignored the law and followed what they purported to call the common law contingency arrangement. that were taken to court, the court upheld the statute. So there is an example where Parliament has stepped in and legislated, made a statute on matters which may be argued to be the regulatory governance of the profession. Surely the answer then, Chair, must be to create the regulate by statute with a requirement. We can write into the law, I think, a requirement for them to inquire into any rules with restrictive effect or which work against the public interest, including access to legal services, and then we require them to make rules on the basis of their inquiry. Then we're not intruding on their regulatory track. It should not be the minister making regulations. And this case can be argued for such, and I think there will be very few such instances. And surely the answer is also that the advocate's chamber makes the rules for the advocates, and the attorney's chamber makes the rules for the attorneys, under the chairmanship, I would argue, of a judge who represents inherent power of the courts. The court has inherent powers over the profession, and that can be Mr. Kettle that we don't include. The simple practical reason for two chambers, there's simply no justification in my view for allowing attorneys by majority decision to decide on bar practice or conduct rules. That's the way the bill now stands. There must at minimum be parity between advocates and attorneys. Judge Chaskelton in the same last speech said that making advocates the junior partner by giving them the smaller representation constituted a weakening of the profession and was inconsistent with independence. So I think you had a choice. You're going to have to give them parity because that's what will be invoked. I go a step further and say you don't just give them parity, you make two chambers as the GCB proposes. Why, Chairman, put the advocates and the attorneys in one body at all? There have been 10 years of tension because five ministers tried to bring together what doesn't belong together. I'm sure you will tell me there were all sorts of other reasons why this bill would never come to Parliament, but one of them surely is the fact that for 10 years the attorneys and the advocates have balked at being put in together because they couldn't agree on the terms of their joint regulations. They don't belong together except in the sense that they are two symbiotic components of one broader profession. But you see, at the end of the day, why institutionalize the tension? It's been going on for 10 years. To this day, they can't agree on a joint proposal to put before us. They cannot agree. So why institutionalize the tension? Just as a matter of simple common sense, rather make two chambers. Let each regulate its own practice and conduct rules and other matters, and then find areas on which they must find answers together. For example, alternative business structures, I think, would be a useful joint function. But let me just say, and this is my last thought, it's all wrong that we should be thinking of the reasons after the fact. Why are we sitting here with Bill Cormick? None of this is clear after us.
Thank you, Chair, and I think Don Wilmots has argued a lot, and I agree with that she has put in many respects. I think it is a very crucial debate that we're having today. And this bill, as we know, has got far-reaching consequences. I align myself with the statements about the independence of the profession being a safeguard for the independence of the judiciary, and the bill states as much. And that's something we need to be very mindful for. And that's what Chaskelton said, and let me just repeat what I said yesterday. Chaskelton said that a structure is being proposed that opens the door to important aspects of the profession being controlled by the executive, and that is inconsistent with an independent legal profession. But here there are a number of arguments that Dean has raised and that I'd like to just add to. The two points are, when we look at legislation, we look at desirability and we look at constitutionality. We got a rich history in the Justice Portfolio Committee of our bills not being contested. And when they have been contested in court, they involve, such as the minimum sentencing bill, they were upheld by the Constitutional Court. And I think we need to look very carefully at this bill. This will definitely end up in a later court. And so we need to look, we need to deal then with the constitutionality argument. And if one looks at the number of issues that I've raised, such as the composition of the council, such as the dissolution of the council, and then, of course, one can argue, as Judge Chaskerton has, that the bill, in its present format, and subject to the further amendments, does infringe on the independence of the profession, which is a safeguard for the independence of the judiciary. If one looks basically at the argument, and that it relates to the framework that the minister can create, and there's definitely a framework for regulatory powers that he can, but when it comes to the governance and management, and that is what is argued strongly by the profession, when it gets to the governance and management of their own affairs, and so we have here a body that's totally different from your medical, from other similar bodies. We've got the essence here relates to the independence of the profession and the independence of the judiciary. And as soon as we start allowing the minister input into that, then we infringe upon the independence. And that opens it for attack. And I'll submit that there's a high likelihood that the profession would succeed in the constitutional attack on the basis of control management and the executive having undue influence in that regard. Now, to meet that, the proposal comes from both the attorney's profession and the advocate's profession to have the two-chamber model. That would meet the constitutional argument. You can still have your legal counsel, and one can look at various models of how one can incorporate the two chambers. It might well be at a regional level. It might well be in the council itself. But I'm sure there is a way that we can find, and yes, Jim, the professions are at fault for not reaching agreement over 10 years. Let's agree with that. Had they reached an agreement, but it's exactly what Ms. Smut said. That tension is now going to be taken forward by us from our side, saying this is how you must work. This is how, and it's not going to, this is going to end up in litigation until, you know, when. So, Chair, I would strongly urge that we look at that firstly from the constitutional angle. Secondly, when we look at the desirability, if we look at the capacity, and this is a strong argument that has been raised, that the day-to-day management of the LSA, the day-to-day management of the GCB, can the present structure deal with that? And I would submit not. At the top level, that would be a policy body, that would be a regulator, but now they are required to do a lot of this work. If one takes it down to a regional level as well, you've still got the different advocates and attorneys that are now forced to come together. And I would agree with Ms. Mutz that we should have parity. They're separate professions, and I think it is to a certain degree simplistic to say that because there are so many attorneys and so many advocates, therefore the numbers should be 10 and 6 or whatever they are. We need to have parity at least with the transition if one is going to go that route. But I would submit, Chair, that the capacity in the day-to-day management, these practitioners are expected to do it without remuneration, and they have been doing it. If you maintain a system with chambers, even at a regional level, that would give us a sense of buy-in from the professions, which is crucial for the successful implementation of the legislation. We need that. That is crucial. Because the attorneys and profession and advocates are their inputs, which is largely done without remuneration, will be crucial for the successful implementation of the bill. So there are only, we can only legislate so far, and a lot of this is going to be dependent on the professions running themselves because of the independence of the professions and the independence of the judiciary. Now, why is it important to have separate chambers? Because there are fundamental differences between the two professions. Fundamental differences. Which I respect, and that is why we have agreed that it's not going to be fusion of the two professions. The training is different. Absolutely, and if I could just quote Advocate Bezos, who quoted what Eminent Kendrick said. He said, "Are few things as essential to the maintenance of liberty in a state as the existence of an independent body of advocates ready to appear for every person in every kind of case." The total difference between the two professions. Now, to lock them together in a regulatory framework without enabling where the advocate's profession is in essence the lesser partner or the minority partner infringes and threatens that essential independence that advocates have in arguing cases. And it's set out in their documents the rich legacy that they've had of taking on cases where big corporate business clients wouldn't. That fierce independence. And there are cases, there's the Rosema case, there are other cases that are cited that goes to the heart of our legal profession. And I think, Chair, that to incorporate some model of two chambers is something that I would strongly urge the majority party to consider in what not what only is good for the profession, but what is good for the independence and the future of our judicial system in the country. It's almost like an olive branch to the profession, and again, accepting the fact that they are at fault for not reaching consensus. But it is a way that we could alleviate a lot of the tensions. We cannot just say, we said in the transitional council, they will resolve all this. They will resolve. It hasn't been resolved for 10 years. But this is a proposal that comes from both professions, the attorney's profession and the advocate's profession. So let's put in some model. I understand it has to be right at the top. It's still where your legal practice comes from, but just below. And that might allay a lot of the concerns that we addressed yesterday with the regional councils. How are we going to deal with the assets? What are we going to do with the liability? If one could even at that level have two councils, two chambers, regional council, two chambers, I think it will go a long way to alleviate constitutional concerns as well as the desirability concerns, and will result in much larger buy-in from professionals. Thank you, Chair.
Can I ask my question?
I mean, the fairness of the debate can we should hold back.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, we are dealing with the structure, and then when you look at the bill, the object of the bill is for restructuring the legal profession. It is so, Chairperson, we come a long way, more than 10 years, dabbling on this issue. And then also, one has to bear in mind to say that we've been, as the legal profession, been overtaken by events. For example, as a legal profession, we've been overtaken by the system of local government. The system of the local government, just to reflect briefly on that, when there was the statutory local government, the Sataras, etc., what they did was they had what was called a two-sided table. On the one side, you had your statutory local government, the Sataras, the Tereas, and the like. And on the other side, you had the Sankos, the residents' associations, and the like. And they discussed came 1995, they had one oral. We had 1995, the wall-to-wall local government, the municipality. In that respect, that's why I said they have been overtaken as a legal profession for professionals. Now, insofar as this is concerned, let me just mention that we used to debate it in the middle 1980s, before democracy. We're talking about the vision of the future, saying what we need to have is the fusion of the power. That's what we're having in workshops. As when I say we, I mean NADEL, the National Association of Democratic Lawyers. We had people running workshops. And one of them is so close to the parliamentary committee today is none other than the late Justice now, Chief Justice Parson. And also the first Justice Minister, Dala Omar, who introduced, who tabled this bill, and it went on through his term, the term by Colonel Maduna, the term by Bishop Mabandra, and at a certain stage by Enver Surti, who is a lawyer, who also engaged with the lawyer trying to engage, negotiate with them. Now, current minister is part of it. But we are still talking about it. And then, to me, when you say to chambers, it's like you are retaining the original structure of the bar inside the bar. And if you are making only minimal changes, it's like you are putting a page on a jacket. But a page on a jacket makes it a new jacket. The answer is no. It remains the old one. And then, what are the lessons? We were a colony of Britain. Britain has moved to an extent from what it was, the bar and side bar. What are the lessons of African countries? Some of the African countries who were British colonies are no longer maintaining these two structures of the bar and the side bar. So why does South Africa still want to retain the cold order? When you talk about transformation, we as South Africans understand transformation differently. When you start listening to people how they look at transformation, you've got diverse or different views. And but I must say that we need to transform. We need to move away from what we were. We need to have the legal profession that is totally transformed. If you know the bar and the red bar, it has also a history which we need not talk about it, because in a way it was sort of very difficult either to be an attorney and thereafter continue to be an advocate. To have a junior degree and a science bar. That is why maybe when you look at the advocate profession, you find that the disadvantaged people, there are very few who manage to go until they reach that situation. All what used to happen was when you pass a matric, go to the university, and then you graduate, your parents, your community, and the like, they think that, oh, you are now qualified. But if you say, I still need to do a postgraduate, or I need to be an advocate, people get surprised. What is it that you still need? And, the attempts that were made throughout, they are very minimal. For example, the attorneys who have been president for more than 10 years, given the right of audience to the High Court and the like. It's an indication that we need to move away from the bar and the right bar because it was a stumbling block in one way. And then in conclusion, maybe we will be doing a disservice to with due respect the late Bala Omar, the late Pius Slanger, if we are not ready to move forward. The threat of being challenged, I think let it be so is my challenge. And we respect the views of such stuff, and we don't know, maybe other people have different views than him. But South Africa is no longer a colony. It's a country which is in the African continent. On my side, I'm saying I'm agreeing to the future. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. The sentence has been covered by Honourable Sulanyoni. Okay, I'll make a short comment, namely that the view that I get from the contribution by Honourable Smuts and Swart is that we need to define the concept of transformation and rationale, which will maybe take longer. And then maybe, Chair, we need to take cognizance of the medical profession in respect of a general practitioner and a specialist. These two bodies regard themselves as one profession. Being a specialist does not mean that you don't cooperate with the GP. So in that sense, I think the status quo is what JP said and agree with.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to start with Honourable Sibanyoni. We aren't an African, we aren't a colony, we are an African country, and we are a constitutional democracy. One of the essential tenets being independent judiciary and independent legal profession, and I think whatever we do needs to be done in that context. I'm not convinced the other way, quite frankly. I think the thing really depends on what is the intention of TPC chambers and what functions are they going for. Because, I mean, we've been arguing the whole time that we need to legislate in the public interest, and the whole bill is about opening up the profession, making it more transparent, making it more accountable in the sense of things like discipline, for example. Now, if we're going to allow the advocates and the attorneys to carry on discipline themselves, that's fundamentally opposed to what the MNP is trying to achieve. And as an ex-attorney, I know, I mean, they may discipline, but if they do, it's not done transparently. People aren't sure what happens. They aren't always convinced that it's been dealt with properly. And on issues like that, to allow the current situation to continue, I don't think it's what we should be doing. On day-to-day management basis, I completely agree. There are valid reasons there, I think, for saying that there are functions that should be done by the independent profession. Because the council can meet, what, four times a year? And there's just no way, realistically, they're going to be able to do everything. But I don't think there's a possibility that we can sort of separate out certain functions that we think could be done independently. But the profession is not that vastly different, that they should be dealing with all aspects of the profession, of each part of the profession separately. There are common interests and there are common aspects. And I think maybe we need to look at whether there's some way we could agree on that, some functions that can be done perhaps by two separate chambers. But overall, the practice council must absolutely have final say over certain aspects and oversight over things like discipline, for example. And I said a while ago, which I was told, it was before my time here, that there was the Badlander model, which sounded to me quite, I mean, if you can have things like requirements for the different bodies to comply with in order for them to be recognized by the regulator, for example. Say, you've got to, every year you have to give us, or every 6 months or however often we want, you have to give us a report on what you've done here regarding the total. What have you done regarding this? What have you done regarding that? What have you done to enhance access to the profession for previously disadvantaged people? Those kinds of things. I don't know if that's something we can look at. But I think just to have a regulator as being a name only and nothing really substantial, I don't think it's right. I do think the issue essentially is one of control. I mean, that is vitally important, and I don't think the council should in any way be seen to be controlled by the executive. And I don't think at the moment that it is. And we can certainly make sure that it isn't when we finish the bill. Because 3 out of 21 is hardly controlled on this. But I think we should maybe just explore this a bit more. But I'm not convinced that necessarily... I don't think that we can say it's because the minister has 3 out of 21 that, is, that he's controlled. But I think I do think it's worth unpacking it a little more, to be honest. Because I don't think we can carry on exactly the same as we currently have it. So, but also now, thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Okay, I just wanted to make just one technical correction with on the slides regarding the contingency fee issue. The lost sight of the Northern Provinces followed the Contingency Fees Act. An attorney argued for the common law. Yes. So that's the point. In favour of the position of the Law Society. Well, the attorney is taking the matter on the table. I think it's the SCA initially. So just that one technical point. And then, insofar as the various differences that Honourable Swart alluded to, Honourable Chen has dealt with most of what I wanted to speak to. And really, the issue of training, and a fundamental change of position had occurred within the committee in terms of seriously considering direct briefing of Africa. It's a fundamental aspect relating to access to the city. And my suspicion from the present is that serious consideration was given to that issue from the perspective of access to justice, cutting off the middleman, so to speak, and allowing an option for an advocate to decide which way he or she would want to practice. And that's a very serious discussion that has happened, and although it's not fusion, it's a choice that a legal practitioner is making, but in the scope of the transformation of the legal profession and of what role the legal profession has to society, it enjoins the issue of access to legal services. In this sense, that the access will be enhanced. And a clear case has been made out for how that is possible. Without in any way taking away the right for an advocate to practice strictly in terms of the current regime of referral provision. And, of course, whether we want to read anything into the comments by the chairperson of the GCB, the committee, having considered that position, will now do away with the current system of referral by the advocate's profession, says that the tax position, because the majority will now swing the other way. What does it say about the entrenchment of the big referral profession debate? I'll leave that aspect there. And then the issue about the vast differences of the entrenchment and the continued case being made out for the referral profession, where we know that the majority of advocates are outside GCB and who have made no case out for referral. They have openly embraced the issue of direct referral. I leave that there as well. So in the context of the discussions that we have with regard to entrenched positions, I think we just need to reflect on the broader aspect in terms of where these entrenched positions come from, and what does it really mean? Also in the context of the rich history of the country, the issue of two chambers, the committees have the power, the council has the power to set up a whole range of committees. In so doing so, the council might decide if a particular committee dealing with a particular matter might want to populate that particular committee with more advocates than attorneys. There's nothing in this draft bill that prevents that from happening. And that possibility will always exist. And if you really get down to the real difference between the advocates and the attorneys, there will be the issue of training, and that is in relation to trial advocacy. Although, what we know is that part of training for attorneys contains a component of trial advocacy that is handsomely done by BLA, who does advocates, to train aspirant attorneys extensively. But the level of trial advocacy for advocates is at a high level. And logically so, because their terrain of operation is in the high court. So that difference equals separation. I need us just to contextualize that aspect. So apart from that, let's look at cab rank rule. That was up raised, but raised by Honourable Swart in a way in which it said that. And of course, I alluded to the fact that the cab rank rule is under review in the rich history of the British colonies that we speak definitely about. And that whole rule is being seriously considered to be extinguished. And I leave that as well, the permission to consider why. So I struggle to really find these major differences between the provisions to the extent that it tantamounts to separation without having that something is going to be done that is going to cause so much friction that the obvious choice to make is, well, leave it the way it is because people are going to get sick. And if you look at the preamble to the bill and what is it exactly that we're trying to do, I think we want to make legal services more accessible to the public. I think we want to transform the legal profession to the level that the public is able to access those services. And is that not really the intention in the context of a single regulatory structure that makes it simpler for attorneys and advocates to operate in one sphere in a profession where the lines are getting more and more murky? And having said that, we then look at what is it that necessitates the continued separation of both arms of the legal profession. And as the other speakers have said, there is no compelling argument insofar as the current system to amend, because there are more advantages in terms of the model that has been proposed in the current law. And those are just some comments that I want us to kindly consider.
One or two small things, Mr. Dyes, and raised quite a few things. I think it's important really just to reaffirm that the bill does recognise the differences between advocates and attorneys and makes provision for that in its committees. Maybe I would just like to question when it's argued that the professions, the two branches within the professions of one to two chamber model, from the attorney's point of view, maybe we should just interrogate that. My understanding is that there are, that is a view held in some quarters in the attorney's profession, not throughout, and to what extent, and I think that's important consideration. And then just more on a broader line, you hear all these truisms, unity and strength, diversity and all those those sort of things. I think that also carried on. And the fact that this committee is also looking for his moving in a, would seem in a direction where advocates can now take briefs directly from the public is an indication that they must work together as a single, in a single body, where there is a recognition of the differences. And I think the recognition of those differences is important, not comfortable to build on that.
The two chamber idea. I think it perpetuates the current dual standard of attorneys and advocates in respect of admission, discipline, training, fees, and the rest. And then I want to emphasize the fact that the public, you know, members of the public, the other way, the people, they expect that there should be some, I would say, uniform standards, as the person is saying. We, as the public, they get surprised when, say, to get to an advocate, you must go via an attorney. Because at the end of the day, just to fight one matter, you end up paying two, I would say, lawyers to use the because you are going to pay the fighting attorney as well as the advocate. And then also to say the purpose of having it as a restructuring it is going to also help to unify the rules. For example, you are moving towards the same rules, because at the moment, if you are an attorney, you must know what are the rules relating to the municipal court and what are the rules relating to the high court. Right? But if you are saying for one profession, I think it's going to assist in harmonizing the rules of court for not only the litigants, but also for the lawyers. It's going to make it easier, making the system to be more efficient. And we must also bear in mind that we should come up with a product that will contribute to the access to justice. To the thank you. I'm not saying we are still hinting for the fusion of the bar and the bar. Definitely all the arguments moved away from that. That discussion of the fusion and the bar.
Now just on that point, I think we may be getting a bit confused as to what exactly we mean. That's why I say I think we really need to understand what we're wanting these chambers to do. Because if we're going to solve the problem of having to go through an attorney and an advocate, it's not going to deal with the issue of fees because we've already decided that's going to be done by another body. And you know, the reality of the matter is, I think in some cases it may save some costs not having to go to an attorney, but in many cases it's not going to. Because the amount of work is such that you will just have to pay two advocates because one won't be able to do it on their own. So I think we might be overestimating the amount of costs that will be saved. But you know, I don't think this is an issue that can be argued against the two chains. It's a separate issue.
Okay. I think we've got different models in our minds as to what we envisage by two chambers. And I think it's very important to tease that out a little bit. Because I think, Chair, I'm very clear. I put it in the statutory framework of a legal practice council. That is that will set the rules and the framework for both professions. That's there. So it's not a business as usual. It's a drastic change. For what is existing. The Bar Council will now come under that statutory framework. And they will be the overriding council and members that decide on the future. But at some level, below that, surely an argument can be made out. I'm not saying the GCB first prize would be in the council top, but clearly that seems from the sentiment expressed that that's not going to have favour. If one looks lower down, I'm sure there's merit to look into a chamber for, and whether it's a committee or whatever you call it. Mr. Dyer, thank you for the suggestion that there's nothing in the bill that prevents something like that at a lower level. But surely we can give a bit of guidance then and say, you know, whether it's in the form of a resolution, but I would like it in the form of the bill or some reference to regulations by the council to look at the possibility of chambers at a regional level to deal with day-to-day management of the different bodies. Because we must accept that there are differences in the two institutions, the two professions. That's why we have agreed it's not the institution, and it's not the same. We are not perpetuating the same model. Most definitely, we've got drastic changes. We've got ombudsman, end of the day, that if a chamber that is dealing with the disciplinary action, he will be, let's assume a chamber at a regional level for attorneys that's dealing with attorneys' day-to-day matters. If anything is done outline, the council steps in. The council will have ministerial representation and other representation. So it's not business as usual. It's a drastic change. But it's a way of compromising and finding a way to get buy-in from the profession. And I think it's something we should seriously consider. I would like to go along with what Mr. Dyer suggested. Let's look at giving, the bill does not prevent it, but let's put something in to give guidance at that regional level at least. Again, I would like it at a higher level, and we'll request an option for that. But something even at a regional level I think could go a long way to meet desirability and constitutional issues that may be raised, and I think it will take the process forward for buying from the profession. Thank you, Jane.
I have no doubt that this aspect, the sense that you asked us to focus on this morning, will remain part of our deliberations. It's important to make deliberations, obviously. I'm not saying, this is not final word on the matter. Clearly it might be. So, you know, there's limited space for us to sway one another, convince one another. We've heard your views, and we should say that in time we must find one another on this. The one point I do wish to make is that the bill is silent on the continued existence or otherwise. Is not saying we're doing a resolution.
No.
So we can end.
It's a resolution.
Yes. But it's
an resolution.
Well, yes. So, you know, the board's not saying GCB is being done away with.
It's saying that another body will take the decision for the GCB and the bar council needs to take the
regulation. Okay. That's something we're going to need to do.
Yes. You never gave me a chance to interact with Mr. Cipollone. And let me just one simple thing, because if, believe me, we will go on thinking about these things, because The constitutional legal issues are absolutely fundamental, so we will have to go on and separate them. Just to offering Mr. Sibanyele, listening to him with great interest, because I think, you know, what I heard from him is the whole history of the 12 years of difficult, intense discussions that occurred. And he spoke truth. He said, look, it is the truth, that people were thinking in terms of fusion. And he used a very vivid example of the local government negotiations, where you had the old border side sitting on one side, and the then ex-parliamentary new order people sitting, the Sankos, etc., sitting on the other side of the table. That is, we know this is where it came from. Confusion was much discussed at the time, but the decision was taken not to travel that road. And I know that Mr. Sibanyele has just acknowledged that. The decision was taken not to fuse the professions, because one of your necessary results is that you then end up only with huge attorney firms for a whole set of reasons. I think South Africa needs a small attorney firm. One of the other reasons why the classic argument about the role of the independent advocate. You need an independent advocate operating as a sole practitioner without an office and admin, so that any attorney's firm, little or big, can brief a good advocate to go and act for somebody, irrespective of how politically unpopular or socially unpopular their case or their cause is. That is how you have justice. And the more intolerance a government may show, the more you need the independent advocate. Mr. Bortvizos remains the prime example. A sole independent advocate can be briefed even by an LRC or another attorney firm to go and represent interests which may be very unpopular with the government of the day. That's why you need independent advocates. That is the whole test. And South Africa knows better than any other country that you need them. We will go on needing them. So for those reasons and other reasons, the decision was taken not to fuse the professions. So I think what remains is a kind of a residue of association of the two professions with the old South African order, and all with England, and all with the colonies. But at least, you know, there's no basis. We've taken the logical, rational decision not to fuse the professions. Wherever, by the way, people did fuse the professions, as in other African countries, as in half of Australia, the closest example is Namibia, they fused the professions. What happened? Everywhere. The same thing happened everywhere. You still have the advocate profession. You still have the bars. Even where people have fused the professions, you still have the two. They're both unnecessary. Each is different. Both unnecessary in any society. So I think that. But I think there's a sort of a residue. We all understand, we've all made the South African Constitution together. But I think that there are no rational, objective reasons to say that two chambers perpetuate dual standards. They don't. The attorney's profession has its own set of practice rules and requirements. The advocates have their bar rules and their conduct rules. They are different, because the professions are different. They simply are, but they are different. And so just to recognize that we have the two professions, it follows to me perfectly logically that you therefore have two chambers. Each of them will be regulating on their own standards. And these, by the way, are not rules, of course. The rules, of course, are made by the rules of the rules. So I think we have to acknowledge the fact that some of the sentiment about restructuring so-called still comes from that old debate. But that debate is over. We are not fusing the provisions. We have two. Now, form should follow function. We create a regulator. Let the regulator form follow the function. And the one difference is that I don't think, because I think this whole rule from the start was conceived of in a vague way. It was all about transformation and restructuring, as just described. And it never crisply identified what were the things that needed to be done. It's now only now with the Minister of AFA that the issue of cost even comes onto the table. And the other countries which have done this vast regulatory reform, item number one was consumers, costs, that has ever even been contemplated until now, which is why the bill is not difficult. It is not. We are now after the fact saying, what is it that advocates and attendees must join us? Why are we even asking that question now? That should be the first question. So those are the difficulties. But I think this has been very useful, thank you, Chair, for me also. I think the vision that the SWOT seems to be approaching is very interesting. You're basically saying at the top you would have a regulator with parity, right? And you slip into your chances at the regionals. I think that's really well worth thinking about. Thank you. But please, let's not forget the legal issues that we're going to end up getting through our court anyway. Now that that's just contemplating the contribution to you.
Such, you know, that on a previous occasion I said to you, and I repeat it now, I'm very intimidated by threats of these things. I refuse, in consideration of this book. So I have no doubt in my mind it's going to happen.
I would put money on it.
It's going to happen. So my responsibility, or our responsibility, must always be to ensure that whatever is in the bill is fine. That's it. Mr. Swatch is correct. We, the justice portfolio, has never been found in that sense. let's not go there. All right. Let's leave it there for now. All right. It's been very interesting, rewarding. Yes. And let's have a 30-minute break.
I didn't know why.
concerned, and you can't use it. That's a chance. That's not spiritual discipline. This stuff is not going to be yours. It's the day-to-day management, the physical activity, the training, the educational development.
Well, we've been listening to that.
And not to see how much of the position they can appeal in the I mean, get a bit of policy of what we're able to
I'm just A group of journalists who were keen, along with this long time ago. Yeah, maybe it's a bit basic for you. It's difficult. You'd have to check it out. It's just done this. Okay. Got what? Yes, yeah. Yeah, but Tess Darling's also got discs, yeah, she's also got CDs, and she had CDs, so she was African bracelet. But if you do a search, you'll see that for dummies. No, I think I'm thinking of French.
So my problem with languages is the vocabulary. You have to learn new words.
Is she in primary school or in high school? Two. And are they in... They've started high school. Because our experience with Isiposo in primary school, and because, you know, all the lefty parents were so keen, and, you know, Isiposo, and, you know, yeah. It's Isiposo, yeah. And getting everybody sort of like, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And the kids actually hated it. And the reason for that was, the teacher came from a pedagogical background, which was, sit still, don't say a word, repeat after me, learn this off by heart, and you just go over the sentence over and over and again. Complete contrast to the sort of progressive kind of teaching, you know, that they were getting from every other teacher. And when we, it was a good couple of years ago, and we missed a stage in invention, but in the nice little way, so it was all about supporting the teacher to make things better. So we started looking for readers in Twitter, and found out that the curriculum wasn't even finalized. I mean, they didn't even finalize. She was operating at the Grove. Now they're in high school. My son's in grade 11 and my daughter's in grade 8. We've deferred. No. India, Helen. I'm not. Yes. I am. Yes. Is she? What are you girls?
Caitlin?
And Alyssa? Do they dance? They're water polo. That's it, water polo. Very. They ended up hating her. be a man. She's a force of nature. Where did they do it? At Feet Valley. You know, I think this is the difference in the picture. So both of them hated it. And when they got, when Jack got to West, there was a choice. He could either do Tulsa or he could do French. There was no chance of doing both. And so he went to French, which he loved. And I think, well, come on, you know, it's so grim. How long have we been married?
Maybe 20 years. I mean,
but it is.
I'm going to go to the next one. I'm going to go to the next one. campaigns and things like that. So there was no resistance to it. And we were actually asked, or the Deputy Minister was asked to consider a way in which community service can be legislated, legislated upon, even if it is at a student level, as block faculty is. And then the DM actually asked us to convey to this committee the so-called encouragement clause that we could put into the bill for universities to be allowed to conduct their community service in a more legislative way or more legal way to encompass it into their LLB degree. So those are the sentiments of the DM, and she asked us to convey to this committee.
Thank you, very interesting. But a clarification.
Yes.
If you say that a few universities have made it a component of the LLB in the law student society, you're saying it's a component of the LLB as part of their preparation. It's not a professional preparation in anticipation of their having to do community service. But no. Okay, that's a very important distinction.
It's basically a course which they would undertake, like a course in street law or a course in legal aid, but they use the term community service.
But I think that's a very different matter from saying the qualified legal practitioners have obligations in respect of community service. I mean, I look sort of opposed to legislating community service for qualified lawyers.
On that point, Chairperson, pro bono .org was also present at this event, and they highlighted what pro bono means and 24 hours which attorneys give off per year in terms of their pro bono obligation. But the sentiment was not only from students, there were lots of other professional attorneys, firms and bodies represented at this discussion, and it emerged that that wasn't enough, and people actually advocated for more of that, and it should be made compulsory because lots of attorneys are not doing it when they should be, you know. And the DM did express view that the portfolio committee, to some extent, felt that it could be punitive, and they didn't want that. They didn't want the burden, you know, placed on attorneys. But it emerged here that it wasn't a burden, and it shouldn't be seen as a burden, and it's something that is very necessary and has to be done in order to give back. And we should actually look at a way in which, if we do legislate, it should not be seen as a burden. But it, there is definitely a need for it to be legislated upon.
What's the
nothing whatsoever to say that it needs to be legislated because currently attorneys aren't doing 24 hours. I mean, then 24 hours in the legislature, but you can't say that it needs to be more because some people aren't doing what they're supposed to do in prison. As far as I understand, it's actually a requirement for them to get their medical certificate to do the 24 hours, certainly in careful stuff. And it could be something like that, but you know, the fact of the matter is it is a burden, particularly for home practitioners, white person practitioners. 24 hours doesn't sound like what they've been, it's out of your practice, and it's all after hours and whatever, and people do various times. But it is a burden, and I mean, it may be. Yeah, we need to discuss. The point is many of them are doing it already. But we do need to perhaps have some ongoing, but I'm not quite sure to what extent, and I don't know if we'd be legislating specific amounts of time, and certainly not excessive amounts of time.
There was the issue raised of possible exemptions for one person practitioner. And also the time period, DM raised with us that the time period is very important, that, you know, it depends on the category, whether it's new graduates or already practicing practitioners, and time period shouldn't be seen as excessive.
I'd like to know what is the definite need? You said if I think it is that they have decided there is a definite need for community service. Now, it would have to be enlightened on what this is. Because we had a long debate that went round and round on this matter in this committee. And for someone like the Honourable John Jeffrey, as he may was, it was pretty self-evident that there's a great need. But it absolutely doesn't follow. You have to tell me what the concrete need is. that the people have to go and attend to. So if the conference decided there is definite need, what form does that need to take?
Thank you. That panel discussion was focused on students performing community service, taking into account that they are not yet qualified. So they really focused on going into communities and advising these rural communities. They went out into places that I hadn't heard of. And they were advising them on their basic rights and assisting them with small legal issues and directing them, you know, to possible avenues where their issue can be resolved, like legal aid clinics and the legal resource center. So that need was more focused on going into communities that are underprivileged and under-resourced and trying to assist them with all legal issues. But the need obviously will differ. As I said, that need was focused on the law students performing community service. It will be different from a qualified attorney performing pro bono as a community service.
That's it. The key distinction between community service and pro bono work at a lawyer. And we've already said it cannot unleash inexperienced candidate attorneys or even students on the public to give, render legal advice and litigate. Totally different from what you're saying, which I think is a positive suggestion, where you advise people of their rights and you advise them about the constitution. And a person comes and says, I can't get pension, and you apply administrative issues. If a person comes with a case, you refer them to a legal clinic. You're not acting as a lawyer as such. The Law Society says that their experience is that candidate attorneys do not have sufficient skill, knowledge or experience to be able effectively to provide pro bono services, that acting as a lawyer. And I think we're all in agreement about that. How one then regulates that community service aspect is what we're grappling with. Whether it be purely, and I would think that it is purely advising people of their rights, and along the lines of what we're talking. And we've got to be very careful as candidate attorneys to even candidate attorneys, unleashing the experienced attorneys, and we know the history of people saying in the about even legal aid, that do incredibly good work, but they are, they're not quite as good as all the other private attorneys. So there's this perception about you not getting best legal advice possible. So it's the standard of legal advice, and then of course, what are we talking about as community service? What length of period are we talking about? I think students, it's a good idea just to go and advise people of their rights, go into community services, but candidate attorneys need to work closely with their principal, as do principals with their advocates. You're working closely together and under close supervision. So there can be no question of a candidate attorney or a pupil going out into a rural area and advising on case and taking on litigation. I think that would be a very dangerous precedent and a very dangerous environment. So we need to find a way around all that. Thanks, Jim.
Students do it. They can do it under the legal offices, the law clinics, because they are then under people in offer qualification, and that's fine. But I mean, there can be no question of them doing it on their own without being supervised as part of the thing. Candidate attorneys are also under supervision of the principal, so there may be some things they can do. But it is very dangerous to allow them to give legal advice on matters that they don't necessarily have the ability to do. But there is one very valuable thing with aspect where qualified attorneys do help, and that is on small claims, a small claim court conversion. And I think that can be expanded also by school as well, because it's enhancing access to justice, there's no legal fees payable, and they are then giving something back to the community.
Thanks. I just want to confirm what the lady said. UK events done this for a long, long time, and what they do, they send the students out, children, third-year students, not good ones. They go out with a supervisor, one of the lecturers or professors, so that they can be guided. I think it's a very good system. They also include, in case they attend, traditional leaders. They go to the traditional course, and given the sort of beautiful city.
Chairperson, yes, I agree that we must be clear about community service and pro bono work. I just have another question. Why, in the case of practical vocational training, post 27, if the council does not establish in the rules, the council must in the rules determine the minimum conditions and procedures and blah, blah, blah. That's for vocational training. But when it comes to community services, now it's the work of the minister. Yes, in consultation, but why is it not solely for the council itself to determine the community service and what type of community services and how it must be regulated?
That is correct, but I think that those examples of community service need revision. For instance, the reservation service of a judicial officer that is output as far as candidate legal practitioners are concerned. It might be something that qualified or admitted legal practitioners could do, but I think that distinction needs to be made there. That needs to be required. And these are some examples. For your candidate legal practitioners, they could, for instance, go and help in assistance at clerical assistance at a small class court. They could work in the clerk of the court, do assistance or have a bit of experience on how civil court operate, because clerks of civil courts play an important role. Clerk of the criminal court. They could. And these are just examples of, and when it comes to the regulations being made, that one can explore in consultation with the legal profession. You've got maintenance investigators, I am really just thinking aloud. They could assist in that role, a crucial role, but not necessarily as a maintenance officer, but in the past, I'm talking 30 years ago, clocks did do maintenance work as well. So, and there's a huge potential for people to go and do something like that as candidate legal practitioners. To confirm that we are very aware that what is done by candidate legal practitioners, care has to be taken. They are not let loose on the public. But it has a very positive effect and a role to play, and there are areas where they can indeed do that.
It's important you make that point, because I clearly recall Advocate Virginia Nolan Lisa making the point after some discussion that he would seriously object to candidates beyond leash on this subject of community. This is not fair. So we need to be mindful of that. So the aspect of him being mentored by somebody is important.
make rules about tariffs or fees, if tariffs and fees are the answer to the problem. So I think you can, legislate and require them to do certain things. So I suggest that we could say you must please make rules on pro bono and practical professional training, and you must please make rules on pro bono service. I think we can do that, but then it's their job to make the rules.
My view is that for community service, we must look at it as an endeavor to try, change the caliber of the legal practitioner that we envisage, namely a lawyer who is not concentrating only on money, but also concentrating on humility, serving the community. In view of the situation we are in South Africa, a large majority of the people either do not have the necessary means to acquire legal services, or where they stay, there are no avenues or facilities where they can access. Now, if we say it's the minister who must prescribe, it is the minister who will be in a position to identify areas or places where there is such a need for the provision of the community service. And then also he would be doing this in consultation with the legal counsel. And further than that, when you talk about community service, I think we should bear in mind we want to emulate our former President Mandela, who did community service for 67 years, uninterrupted community service, who he was a lawyer. And then I think taking that, all that into consideration, the idea of doing community service by a lawyer is something which needs to be supported.
I'm just thinking of a suggestion here which you may wish to consider. I mean, would it not be worth putting something like the following? Council must make regulations providing for a period of community service and also pro bono work fees performed by all these practitioners and upon which their continued registration is dependent. And then make sure that there is provision for some, they leave it up to them how much, and it's a bit more flexible, and then the council may just
I'm not sure I like that there's a continued registration between their hands, but I've been all of them into the exactly right. Actually, is proving a point about what we called it perhaps unkind agreement, but he is proving the point. Because in South Africa, these people must have learned new laws. Exactly the wrong kind of require service from people. I will be clear your political education. That's what we mean when we say this is a punitive position. It must really genuinely serve the people who are opportunity to serve. It doesn't bring a mind change to the person or sense.
I'm just trying to do we all have the same understanding? We were trying to understand the difference between community service and pro bono work, and I think that is an important distinction. As soon as we have the minister identifying areas or places where there is a need, surely are we then looking at an extended period of sending someone to an area? And I think we need to tease that out in the context of what are we saying, because we've got to be very careful how that would operate in practice. We're not talking about the medical community service. We're not. where you go for a year to a hospital. So that we're talking about a different form of community service. And surely the profession or whoever would decide how that, or council should decide how that operates. And I think, yeah. And the minister might have an interest because this is also a community issue. He's represented on the council as well. So, but it's an issue we need to all have that same understanding, be on the same page. What are we thinking about? What are we thinking about? Thank you.
Chair, I think we can learn a lot from the Department of Social Work, because social workers in every university, in the third year, they go out to do this kind of community work, and we can get a lot of ideas from them. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, on the questions that Ms. Adams and Mr. Swarker raised on the time period, maybe the time period shouldn't be set there, maybe it should be left open. But the idea is to try and answer those questions. Is community service as part of vocational training, we see as there must be some time given during the course of your vocational training to community service. Community service in sense where no damage can be done, where there's no prejudice like spoken about. Details, and I think we must try and convey that in an option that we prepare, must allow for, if it's going to be done under supervision, you must take the practical realities in mind. You could do it intermittently. You could do it for a solid period. If a period is going to be 2 weeks, or if it's going to be a month, see the footnote here, even 2 or 3 months is an indication that might be too long. So it might not be prudent to put a time period in now, but to convey the sense that community service must be done, and I think the department feels quite strongly, particularly as far as practical vocational training is concerned, because it can make a big difference, not only for the candidate legal practitioner, but also for society, and it must be compulsory. The length, as I say, can be debated on when the time arrives to do council's rules or regulations, but I think it must be put in such a way that it can be done one day this month, one day next month, or if the circumstances allow, or that would be preferable, they do 2 weeks here or the entire minimum period dealt with. And I think then it's also important we have another provision dealing with community service by admitted legal practitioners, and I appreciate a bit more guidance there. And I think it's also important to include a provision to allow for exemptions, particularly as, well, only as far as admitted illegal practitioners are concerned. There might be times where there are justifications for a legal practitioner to opt out for very good reasons.
Chairperson, I agree with Mr. Bassett is saying. I'm just thinking now, normally when we talk about community services, we talk about being in direct contact with the community and having those persons coming to explain their problems and things like that. But we're also talking about the pupils, I suppose so. But remember, there is this referral rule that we have tried to relax now. And how does that affect the whole thing of community services? Because if I'm a pupil, as much as my mentor will be present, hopefully, are we saying that at all times an attorney should also be present, or a clerk, once we do our community services, or what does it entail for a pupil? I'm just thinking about the practical explanation, or how what do we envisage with that? Because if I'm a pupil at a bar, let's suppose we go to some law clinic. Let's suppose the law clinic, we're going to do community services there. Exactly. So there are these kind of rules that we also have to just think about.
Ms. Smith.
Chair, there are lots of practicalities that are going to have to be thought about. But those details are going to come into the regulations or the rules or whatever. And I'm speaking off the top of my head again. There might not be a situation where the principal or the mentor in the case of pupil has to be there all the time. You might land up doing community service as a maintenance investigator. Then you're all under the jurisdiction or tutor or whoever's in charge of that particular. And these are the unknown factors that are going to have to be taken into consideration when you get to that side.
I think there's one more what should be in the bill is the fact that there must be regulations providing for full access. Where we don't have agreement at this point, whether there should be an open this, and whether it should be left entirely to the council. Okay? Because on the one hand, the SMAP said leave it to the council, and the fear has been expressed, yes, we're running the council. In such a regulation that no one would do. Well, that's the point I'm making. So as far as that's concerned, so that's it. We can give us that third option, which is whereby the minister is not involved, and if the council is making the regulations or rules.
Include in there the exemption that option for an exemption for practitioners in the
region. If you don't want to leave that to the
council. We could also.
Well, you are back, so maybe you want to keep that at the time you could.
No. We need to be clear. You see, Debbie is saying she wants the exemption put in there.
No, because we
leave that to the council to provide for the exemption.
No, my concern is that we're imposing an obligation on the council to provide for a period of community service for all petitioners. So I think that is necessary to at least indicate that we do envisage that they can give exemption in certain deserved cases for one good reason.
I was just thinking that if it's there, maybe we should decide whether it's going to be from Calgary or from but also, if it's there, Chairperson, I think we would be assisting legal practitioners, because obviously a legal practitioner is not a person who likes to be a legal practitioner for us. Who like to have progression. When these legal practitioners appear before the Judicial Service Commission, they are interviewed, they are asked what has been your contribution, and find that a person has been a lawyer for many years, top advocate, and then when it's being asked what has been your contribution, it's zero. And then people get surprised when a person who's got a lesser number of years who has gone a mile further and did something voluntarily for the community, get recommended and appointed to be a judge. Mm-hmm. That's all I want to put.
Well, apparently it's going to be compulsory, so that's all. That's the whole purpose.
It will also pointed out to me the other day, well, after I raised the issue of incentives and so on, whereas apparently it is often taken into account in, for example, the safety interviews and how much have you done, what have you done, training and so on. So maybe that's also an incentive in itself.
Very good incentive.
If I have a lot of money as a legal practitioner and I just want to do community services,
I mean, isn't that to be?
When I have the money, I can do them.
No, you won't. Sorry, silence. Good try.
No. Well, I don't know. Should we break now for lunch?
Confess that I might not be able to tackle exactly for all the stuff, so I'm willing to go on for them.
No, let's stop now. I think it's an important point that we go past this community service. I think we've exhausted everything for now. We've instructed them to give us that third option to look at. And then when we get back, we'll look at what you move on to do. All right? Thank you.
Thank you.